Welcome to another of the Maine Humanities Council's Humanities on Demand podcasts. Here, Rutgers professor Diane Sadoff gives a talk during Winter Weekend 2013 entitled Great Expectations, The Dickens Legacy and Its Cinematic Afterlife.
Charles Dickens enjoys one of the longest literary afterlives of any 19th century novelist. Having survived the two centuries since his birth in February 1812, by attracting academic and general readers and spectators of visual and cinematic media and staged performance. The fledgling writer, Boz, invented himself as an author, established himself as a cultural celebrity, for his promotional genius and commercial crassness helped promote his publications, disseminate his image, and cultivate his fame. Indeed, Dickens merchandised his books through a variety of innovative strategies, including the public reading tours, in which he did all the voices in the scene in which Bill Sykes murders a martyred Nancy. Here he is after one of the readings. Exhausted! Dickens's uncanny self-marketing meant that he was constantly in print, and so in the public eye. His books were tranched down after serial publication, first as triple-deckers for rent at the popular circulating libraries, then as cheap editions that made the inimitable, one of his nicknames for himself as author, a household name all over Britain. And finally, as collected works, both expensive and inexpensive, for specialist readers and wealthy collectors. Indeed, Dickens has become a cultural commodity. His brand, as we might now call it, sells the novel's emotional appeal, which softens Dickens' narrator's rage at the many oppressive social institutions he pillories. By the time he wrote Great Expectations in 1860, Dickens was in the pantheon of best-selling authors. He had published 12 novels and 5 Christmas books, along with collected periodical sketches and occasional pieces. He'd begotten 10 children, separated from his wife, Catherine Hogarth Dickens, and begun a relationship with the young actress Ellen Ternan, whom we now know was his companion until his death. Ellen seems to have been an enduring and idealized love, much like the one he experienced for his young sister-in-law, Mary Hogarth. Peter Ackroyd, one of the recent biographers, notes that Dickens obliquely described Ellen as a princess out of storybooks. She seemed already in his lifetime to have become like a, quote, creature from his imaginary world and a figment of his heart's desires. Yet Estella is clearly a figure for Ellen, and she represents some of the complex feelings Dickens may have had about that largely secret beloved. In 1860, he analyzed this paradoxical desire. For writing about his youthful Great Expectations, Pip begins to realize that he had misunderstood, even denied, Estella's fatal attractions. Pip's tale then narrates a quest for a seemingly unattainable love and rehearses grandiose dreams of upward social mobility, of becoming a gentleman. The structure of retrospection, of the backward look, provides this fictional autobiography much of its power. For the expressive speech in the storytelling present recounts the feelings that belong to the boy as the adult narrator rethinks his past acts and experience in light of present knowledge. When Pip claims that he, quote, often served Mrs. Joe as a connubial missile, unquote, the metaphor and vocabulary which identify Pip's body as a pawn in a marital struggle belong to the fictional speaker, the adult Pip, although his affective experience is located in his childhood past. Pip's narrative depends upon the doubled nature of this retrospection, which draws the reader's attention to the split between the boy's youthful fears and wishes and the adult's more mature judgments. Indeed, the distinction between adult self-reflection and childhood experience everywhere energizes this first-person retrospective narrative. When the character Pip recalls his first visit to Satis House, he narrates his youthful adventures to an admiring Joe, Mrs. Joe, and Pumblechook. If they had asked me any more questions, I should undoubtedly have betrayed myself, for I was even then on the point of mentioning that there was a balloon in the yard, my invention being divided between that phenomenon and a bear in the brewery. Now, when I saw Joe open his blue eyes and roll them all around the kitchen in helpless amazement, I was overtaken by penitence. Yet Pip's word now refers to a moment before the present moment of the narrator's speech, recalling when, as a youth, he told these tall tales. And his then refers to the boy's immediately past experience, the moment behind the time of young Pip's account of the wonders of Satis House. The intensifier even suggests that although Pip's penitence belongs to the recalled past, the time of young Pip's lies, it must be recovered in the adult narrator's present moment of utterance. This temporal layering makes us sympathetic with the guilt-ridden boy, even as the adult narrator elicits the reader's judgment of that boy's imaginative grandiosity. In Great Expectations, memories recovered or produced by the backward glance unsettle the fictional look of things, as the narrator, who is also our protagonist, blends scenes of past and present. When the convict turns him upside down, Pip's perspective creates a cinematic moment of tilt and roll, a spatial dislocation of figure and ground within the scene recovered by retrospection. When the church came to itself, for he was so sudden and strong that he made it go head over heels before me, and I saw the steeple under my feet, when the church came to itself, I say, I was seated on a high tombstone, trembling. He gave me a most tremendous dip and roll so that the church jumped over its own weathercock. Then he held me by the arms in an upright position on the top of the stone. Pip's language identifies this scene as having been visualized by a naive and frightened child, and his final position on top of the tombstone seeks to stabilize for himself and the reader a sense of the world being out of kilter, which the topsy-turvy encounter with the convict produced. As Pip's story ends, moreover, the tombstone reappears. The matured Pip places little Pip on the tombstone, and this scene identifies Pip as second father to Joe and Biddy's child, little Pip, a figure for his young self, but redeemed, given a second chance to act on Pip's missed opportunities, yet to forego his expectations and take his rightful place at the forge. The boy's sense of terror is spoken in the narrator's present, sometimes wry, voice, as cued by his words, I say. For the adult speaks from his narrating present moment, but the boy was trembling, as the present and past tenses capture the uncanny doubling of temporality in the retrospective narration. As narrator, Pip explains this logic. In the little world in which children have their existence, there is nothing so finely perceived and so finely felt as injustice. It may be only small injustice, but the child is small, and its world is small, and its rocking horse stands as many hands high, according to scale, as a big-boned Irish hunter. Scale and perspective cause spatial disorientation, the adult Pip claims. The small child, looking up, misperceives the sizes of things, and so misapprehends feelings proper not only to things, but to narcissistic hurts as well. Pip's lies about Satis House blend scenes of exotic, fantastic beings and objects, balloons, bears, and beer, with those of decay and disuse he sees at Miss Havisham's grotesque mansion. His story prominently features adult language about fabrication or invention, forgery, counterfeiting, swindlers, self-swindlers, language that retrospectively reassesses Pip's youthful misrecognitions. Pip recalls himself as a boy spying Jaggers's office skylight, quote, eccentrically patched like a broken head, and the distorting adjoining houses looking as if they had twisted themselves to peep down at me through it, unquote. Here, Pip blends a recalled scene of London buildings, and he personifies or makes human their apparent perception, as though glass were a distorting lens capable of generating the boy's feeling that misshapen things in the world, here buildings, might stare at him, single him out, accuse him of criminal taint. As he runs across the moors with Mrs. Joe's pork pie, Pip fancies that objects run and animals speak, that the gates and dikes and banks came bursting at me through the mist, as if they cried as plainly as could be, "A boy with somebody else's pork pie, stop him!" The cattle came upon me with suddenness, staring out of their eyes and steaming out of their nostrils. "Hello, young thief." David Lean's 1946 film faithfully adapts this last scene, complete with hilarious bovine voiceover. As these passages show, Pip's language often includes the phrase, "as if," which opens out the boy's richly imaginative world, even as the adult retells its events. These words enable the reader to see the world of the novel through Pip's eyes. Yet because the phrase, "as if," is spoken by Pip as narrator about what his childish self felt and saw, it inflects his story's grammar strongly toward past events that might have happened but not been fully realized or realized at all, or that reveal conditions that appear false or improbable. When apprenticed by the justices, for example, the boy imagined, and the narrator captures, an irreality, for young Pip surmises that Pumblechook pushed him, quote, "as if I had at the moment picked a pocket or fired a rick," that Pumblechook held him, quote, "as if we had looked in at the court on our way to the scaffold." But Pip did not fire a rick, nor was he en route to his own hanging, but to the forge, despite the rebellious, revolutionary, and criminal narratives spun out here through the energy of the narrator's recounting of the retrospective look. These words testify, moreover, to the presence of childish images and concepts within Dickens's mature, disillusioned worldview. They point to the persistence of juvenile feelings as a source of Dickens's magical invention. The phrase "as if" also expresses Pip's disavowed feelings of dread, terror, and anxiety. He fears, for example, possible violence against his young self. The man with the file at the Jolly Bargemen acts, Pip imagines, as though he were cocking his eye, as if he were expressly taking aim at me with his invisible gun, as if he were determined to have a shot at me at last. Orlick, jealous of Pip's promotion at the forge, lunges at him, as if he were going to run a red-hot poker through my body. But instead, he whisked it round my head, laid it on the anvil, hammered it out, as if it were I thought, and the sparks were my spurting blood. Here, Pip's self-conscious phrase, "I thought," creates a self-reflection about the past fear of being hurt, even as he utters these words in the present, enabling the adult Pip's and our judgments of his past dread. The phrase "as if" also expresses Pip's disavowed boyish desires to harm those who demean and declass him. During his second visit to Satis House, Pip follows the pale young gentleman as if he had been under a spell. The boy, Pip recalls, commands, "come and fight." Eyeing my anatomy as if he were minutely choosing his bone, Pip expresses surprise when, after the first blow, he saw the boy lying on his back, looking up at me with a bloody nose and his face exceedingly foreshortened. Here, the phrase "as if" protects Pip from the necessity to claim his own violent acts as belonging to him, yet expresses his inability to act in the face of the possible violence he imagines that upper-class characters may wield against him. He recalls in the chapter that follows the fight, for example, quote, "I felt that the pale young gentleman's blood was on my head and that the law," capital L, "would avenge it," unquote. Likewise, during his first visit to Satis' house, when Estella takes pleasure in causing the boy's tears, she treats him, he imagines, as insolently as if I were a dog. Pip retaliates. He fancies he sees her, quote, pass among the extinguished fires and ascend some iron stairs and go out by a gallery high overhead as if she were going out into the sky. Then he recalls, I saw a figure hanging by the neck on a great wooden beam, a form in yellow, white, and faded trimmings, beckoning as if she were trying to call to me, unquote. Terrified, Pip runs from and then toward this paradoxically accusatory and helpless effigy of Miss Havisham, yet finds no figure there. Here, the phrase as if signifies Pip's hallucination as a disavowed wish. It mixes instances of looking with retrospectively recaptured feelings of gloomy satisfaction, of delight in abjection, and retaliatory, if unconscious, violence. Even at his story's end, Dickens has not quite come to terms with what the adult narrator knows about the boy's pursuit of gentlemanly status and sexual fulfillment. Pip's backward look at his boyish expectations of future financial, marital, and familial gain is everywhere hedged with his adult hesitance, doubt, and knowledge of their improbability, even delusionality. This tension between fatalism, the strong belief that he cannot control future events, and expectation, the belief that he will gain wealth, happiness, and leisure in the future, creates the novel's dense vision of multiple contrary prospects for the boy and his destiny. As such, it authorizes the problematic multiple endings, the original of which inscribed the triumph of probability over possibility. Suffering had given her a heart to understand what my heart used to be. And the three revised versions of 1861 and 1862, which open out possible vistas of reunion with no shadow of another parting. Let me return to Dickens as a cultural commodity, a brand that sells youthful emotion and imagination as shaped by mature reassessment. Yet perhaps the major salesmanship happens at Christmas time. This is, of course, Tiny Tim and Toby Cratchit. When Dickens' stories appear on stage or as performative or spectacular reenactment, the McCarter Theater in Princeton, New Jersey, where I live, plays A Christmas Carol annually. At Mount Hope Estate and Winery in Pennsylvania, the month-long December event called A Dickens of a Christmas features a heart-rending version of Scrooge's adventures with the ghosts of Christmas past and present, and a costumed Charles Dickens hosts the gala dinner. In December 2012, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, Dickens's last unfinished and rather dark novel, opened on Broadway as a musical comedy. In fall 2011, Oprah Winfrey chose a one-volume edition of A Tale of Two Cities and Great Expectations as her featured book club reading. Reaching a mass audience, Winfrey no doubt stimulated the all-important Christmas sales, as do all of the Dickens Christmas paraphernalia. The Dickens icon also appears in multiple print, visual, and material cultural media. In 1947 and again in the 1990s, Great Expectations became a classics illustrated comic book. The first sketches the novel's characters exactly as David Lean had pictured them in his 1946 masterpiece. The second, in the 90s, as a camp parody of Pip's sexual obsession with Estella. On the web, the company, Great Expectations, advertises itself as the nation's premier video dating service for singles. Guess they didn't read the novel. And at the mall, the Great Expectations shop encourages conspicuous consumption of maternity gear. Guess they didn't read the novel either. Yet other Dickens novels also enjoy a robust afterlife, in particular, Oliver Twist. In 2008, Walt Disney Pictures re-released a 20th anniversary DVD of its Oliver and Company, in which the boy orphan becomes a kitten, The Dodger is a street-smart mutt, Fagin, the owner of pilfering puppies, and Bill Sykes, a loan shark. One trailer for the film includes an online video game so that youthful viewers may play along with the larceny. When Oliver is rewritten as graphic novel, it parodies Oliver's orphan adventures, as Will Eisner's Fagin the Jew mixes criminality, boyish vulnerability, and romance with Jewishness to spoof the concept of classic English literature. The BBC, not to be left behind, shot a 5-episode Masterpiece Theater, Oliver, in 2007, costuming actor Timothy Spall as an observant Jew and casting Sophie Okonedo as a mixed-race Nancy. Yet Great Expectations plays a crucial part in the Dickens legacy, largely, I would argue, because David Lean's mid-century classic shoots Dickens's marshes in gritty black and white, creating a cinematic equivalent of the adult's look back, of Pip's language of as if. The sequence
and
opens
my
with
Christian
a
name,
metaphor
Philip,
for film adaptation.
My infant tongue could make of both names nothing longer or more explicit than Pip. So I called myself Pip and came to be called Pip.
Voicing over the novel's famous first lines, Lean announces his intention to shoot a film faithful to its source novel. As the camera tracks in and the novel's first pages turn, Lean dissolves to the marshes. A boy crosses a horizontal landscape, punctuated by two vertical structures, toward one of which, a gallows, a boy runs, moving from background to foreground. Dissolve, as the boy scrambles over a stone hedgerow and into a cemetery. On the soundtrack, wind blows. A tree creaks. The boy plants flowers on his parents' grave. As a bird squeaks, he looks up at tree limbs in fright. Then, cut to his look again, he sees a tree trunk he imagines grimacing at him, our first as-if moment. Cut to the boy's encounter with the criminal.
Keep still, you little devil, or I'll cut your throat.
Who turns him upside down, chains clanking, and then on the tombstone. As the film closes, Lean creates a cinematic equivalent of the retrospective narration that grants the print novel its power. When Pip returns to Satis House, Lean voices over what phrases name? Once spoken by Estella. John Mills, as the adult Pip, smiling ruefully, opens the squeaky gate.
Come in, Pip.
He enters and looks around the garden, then up at the clock tower, as Miss Havisham voices over.
I know nothing of days of the week, nothing of weeks of the year.
Don't loiter, boy.
Pip enters the house. Cut to his backlit figure, his black silhouette framed by the open doorway, with brightly lit garden in the background. He enters the hall and repeats the boy's gestures, putting his hat on the mantelpiece.
Whom have we
walking
here?
Upstairs
a
with
boy.
A candle.
Boy of the neighborhood, eh?
But he is a common laboring boy.
He hears the famous phrase, common laboring boy.
This door, boy.
As he reaches Miss Havisham's room and enters that, cut to his surprised look at the adult, Estella. Yet Lean plays fast and loose with the novel's conclusion, revising Dickens's original unhappy ending and his rewritten ambiguous ones. Lean's Pip denounces Estella's intention to become her dead guardian. He proclaims himself her savior.
To let in the sunlight!
As he to tears drapes from the windows. Dust blowing. Light flooding the frame as sitting in Miss Havisham's chair, Estella faces her adoptive mother's props on the vanity. The same gloves, Bible, mirror, brush, pearls. The music swells, cueing spectatorial pleasure.
Look, Estella, look! Nothing but dust and decay.
I've never ceased to love you, even when there seemed no hope for my love. You're part of my existence, part of myself. Estella, come with me, out into the sunlight. Look at me.
Pip, I'm afraid.
Look at me. We belong to each other. Let's start again. Together.
After avowing their love, the sweethearts exit the house and garden, and as they look back for a last time, close the gate behind them. For most of the students I teach in my seminar on Dickens and film, Lean's ending destroys his adaptation, damaging the opening's claim to authenticity and fidelity. There were boos all around the room when I showed this clip in the fall. Yet shooting just after World War II, Lean films Dickens' fable of upwardly mobile and gentrifying masculinity to present to Anglo-American viewers a portrait of successful manhood after the Blitz, after the massive war deaths, the wholesale relocation of children and breakdown of the family, and the ravaging of the British pre-war economy. More recent adaptations eschew cinematic equivalents for the novel's retrospective narration, the as-if imaginary, as signified by the boy's look and the narrator's look back. Cinema, after all, has no tenses, and enunciation, that is the scene you see while you're watching, always takes place in the present, which accounts for Lean's use of voiceover to signify pastness and repetition. Recent filmmakers, moreover, adapt Dickens for a turn-of-the-century moment drenched with anxiety about rising income inequality. Alfonso Cuarón's 1998 Great Expectations updates the story for the favored Hollywood demographic, 14 to 34 years of age. You'd never know it when you go to the theater. And it's in this first clip, Cuarón modernizes Pip's quest for fame, wealth, and sexual bliss. Here, Miss Havisham becomes, in Anne Bancroft's Miss Dinsmore, a flashily costumed and made-up harridan. Gwyneth Paltrow, as Estella, announces the film's historical moment.
Where are you going, dear?
I have to get ready. I have that cocktail thing at the Rewalds.
Lane Rewald. Gin Blossom. One more cocktail, we'll be able to eat him.
Carl Rewald. Lane is his father. Carl doesn't even drink.
Cue balls. The whole family's pickled. Who's your escort?
Escort? Please, this is the 80s. I'm going by
I'll
my...
I'll bring you.
Estella links the 1980s, a decade of leveraged buyouts and exorbitant spending, with liberated sexual mores. And Cuarón's Estella is an 80s liberated girl, seeking sex when she wants it, and when she's done, walking out on Finn, our renamed Pip. When Finn sketches the bad girl sex pot, Cuarón fetishizes the female body, shooting body parts rather than the whole nude. Her back to Finn and the spectator, Paltrow unbuckles her bra, then as the camera tilts down her body, drops her spandex miniskirt, and it's still tilting down, her panties on the floor. Here, Cuarón successfully shoots the male gaze as we look at Finn looking at Estella, reproducing her naked body, but touching the private parts only on paper. I have the DVD with me if anybody wants to see that scene later. It's a famous scene. Everybody says, oh, yeah, that Great Expectations, the one where Gwyneth Paltrow takes her clothes off. Right. The film paradoxically criticizes Hollywood for its exploitation of the nude female body. Yet Cuarón is complicit with such cashing in, for he too markets, even as he pans, star images. In this scene, the vulgar and trashy Miss Dinsmore puts on her makeup as Finn and the spectator watch.
I expect an invitation.
I'm sorry?
To your open.
Shooting her look at herself in the magnifying mirror, Cuarón highlights her red-haired wing, rubber mask, wrinkled skin, inked-in beauty spot, and garish eye makeup in grotesque close-up. These star images commodify performers' faces and bodies, advertising the making and marketing of artistic celebrity. And Cuarón's film moves from marshy Florida to the art capital of the world, New York City, where Finn is an instant celebrity. The aptly named Here Comes Success plays on the soundtrack as Finn enters a gallery showing his work, especially the Estella sketches, and we watch as critics praise society girls' coup and fans adore. And everyone got the memo to wear green.
She's not here yet, but when she gets here, I'll send it right to you.
Right. Congratulations. Great job. Oh,
thanks a lot.
But Finn's artistic success proves due to Jagger's advertising and marketing. His star image is just that, an empty likeness. Based solely on a manufactured stardom in Cuarón's film, Finn's faux fame updates Dickens's ambivalent 1860s take on masculine ambition, sexual obsession, and social climbing. Sarah Phelps's 2011 BBC dramatization borrows Lean's conception and Cuarón's opening shots as the convict emerges from the sea with uncanny music on the soundtrack spooking the spectator. Track from Tombstone to the Boy, tearing dead brush from his parents' grave. Alarmed by bells from the ships at anchor, he runs from the graveyard. Only to be knocked down by the criminal lurking below a bridge. Yet Phelps writes after the Great Recession wrecked Britain's and Americans' financial expectations, and her take on the novel makes Jagger's criminal milieu into a world of money, markets, and social climbing. Mrs. Joe, for example, immediately responds to Uncle Pumblechook's announcement that Miss Havisham wants a boy by chortling, "We're all going to be raised up. We're associating with the quality now." Uncle Pumblechook may be even greedier than Mrs. Joe, for when Orlick beats her into silence after she threatens to fire him, Pumblechook mutters about benefiting from Havisham's supposed beneficence. "It's too late for you, lady, but not too late for me." When Pip asks Wemmick to find Herbert a position, he responds like a Wall Street broker. Clarriker needs £500 to close the deal. Phelps dramatizes Estella's story as revealing the objectification of women. When in London, Estella moans to Pip, "I'm tired of being looked at, tired of being evaluated." Her chaperone sneers in response, "This is a market. All the stock must be assessed." Cut to Pip and Bentley Drummle, who visit a gentleman's club that's really a brothel. Drummle offers Pip his choice of scantily clad women from across the British Empire. When Pip demurs, Drummle scoffs at his sexual virginity, social aspirations, and loose habits worth money. "You're not one of us, and you know I know, don't you, Pippy?" he sneers. In the film's funniest line, and I don't think it's intentional, when the abusive husband, Drummle, is thrown from a horse and dies, the newly liberated wife, Estella, kisses the horse and whispers, "Thank you." Yet Phelps's message sets these 21st century economic evils against a seemingly innate human goodness more sentimental than was Dickens's shrewd novel. When Magwitch returns from Australia, she tells the adult Pip, he tells the adult Pip, it wasn't the file, it was the pie given out of goodness that made him become Pip's benefactor. When Pip parts with Herbert and Clara, each hugs Pip as tears threaten. After Magwitch dies in prison, Pip returns to the forge. I don't deserve you, he tells Joe, who forgives, complete with bear hug, promising they are ever the best of friends. And when Pip visits Satis House at the episode's end, the director features Pip's and Estella's look at each other. Cokie Guidroyk shoots Pip looking at Estella, who looks back at Pip from a window. She sighs on the soundtrack. Then runs down the stairs to meet him, breathing expectantly. The soundtrack's sentimental music. The slow motion shot reverse shot as they approach. The track in as they meet. Circling them in close-up two-shot as their foreheads touch, all signify sentimental romance. Phelps's dramatization suggests, and Guidroyk's serial emphasizes, that a happy ending is possible because goodness, generosity, and love, friendship, hugs, and tears may prevail over ambition, greed, and class climbing. Dickens's first publications, we've read one of the last, but his first publications invented a new hybrid fictional form, one we have come to call the Victorian novel. And the self-begetting writer, Charles Dickens, launched and later nurtured the celebrity that enabled him to create himself as a novelist. That self-creation initiated and later mobilized his long cultural legacy, his afterlife in the 20th and 21st century. By the bicentenary, Dickens had become a global cultural star. He even inspired a theme park, like all good celebrity franchises, Dickens World, outside London. Thank goodness Charles Dickens is not the unique, impossible to copy, inimitable, but a vibrant figure in contemporary print, cinematic, dramatic, and material culture. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and from friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.